non-public.
I agree with that. The room would be full.
Is open. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 800. We had a brief overview from Paul first, and then we'll call Senator Devlin up.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 800 establishes a task force on reserve funds. And if you look on in Section 1, Sub 2 of the bill, it lists what the task force should do. That's to review the existing constitutional and statutory funds, the Education Stability Fund and Rainy Day Fund, determine whether funds reflect the economic volatility of the state, determine whether the current limits on deposits into the funds are appropriate, determine whether the sources of deposits into the fund are adequate, determine whether limitations on expenditures of monies in the funds are useful in balancing economic fluctuations in the state, determine whether diverting earnings from the Ed Stability Fund is appropriate, identify current constitutional statutory provisions that may need modification, identify new provisions that would aid in efficient functioning of the funds, and finally, to recommend a comprehensive package of constitutional statutory changes from our management practices designed to enhance the effectiveness and performance of the funds. So that's all in Section 2 of the bill.
Thank you. And you have a more long form slide deck that you want to go through.
Just some background material for the committee, yes.
Okay. And first we'll take Senator Devlin up to explain the need to explore the nuances of stability funds.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Thank you for this opportunity. I may recall a little bit of history first. I think, although Mr. Warner will probably go through it more thoroughly. Many of you have been here a fairly long time. Some of you went through the 2002 special sessions. I did. In those five special sessions, we actually had no reserves except for the accrued balance in the tobacco master settlement and the ability to actually ultimately in the fifth special session to actually issue bonds so we could continue operating. That's a much misunderstood post that era. We had actually been cutting continuously in each special session, and we arrived at the fifth special session and we couldn't quite honestly cut fast enough to stay in the black. So we borrowed for the first time to actually keep operating, and as you may recall, it's been only about a year since we paid off those bonds, less than a year. In 2003, the Education Stability Fund was established. In 2007, the Oregon Rainy Day Fund was established. In 2009, in the depths of the recession, we nearly completely depleted both of those funds. In fact, at the end of that biennium, we had $15.6 million, I believe, left available between the two funds, barely even like taking a couple of extra cents to pay us if in case you had any extra expenses. In 2011-13, we had just been through the depths of the recession. Most of the additional federal dollars that we received during the depths of the recession had been exhausted, almost all of them. We had no reserve funds left. We were left with from current service level, potentially as high as about a $3.5 billion shortfall. During that particular biennium, the reserve funds went into the accounts and out of the accounts almost simultaneously, like in one pocket and out the other. Those of you that were here during that session, which I believe is most of you, you know that there really wasn't much choice in that, given what our fiscal position was. This is the first biennium when we've started to replenish those funds. At the end of this biennium, June 30th, I believe we'll have about $387 million between the two funds. In the 2015-17 budget, the governor's recommended budget diminished the contribution to the general purpose rainy day fund by taking the ending fund balance down to half of 1%, or about $98 million short of what we had promised to put into it. The co-chairs and their framework restored that. So there'll be about $198 million going into the Education Stability Fund into the Rainy Day Fund. At the end of this coming biennium, 15-17, we will have about $746 million in reserve funds. Where we will be with the $746 million reserve in 2017, when you think about it, it will be almost 10 years since the beginning of what people now refer to. I don't think actually the people refer to the Depression as the Great Depression, but somehow we refer to this as the Great Recession. But it'll be almost 10 years. Will we have a downturn before then? Maybe. Will we certainly have a downturn sometime in the relatively near future, the next 4 to 6 years? Probably, most certainly. Will we be prepared? Probably not. In 2017, those reserve funds will only equal probably about 4% of what I anticipate the general fund lottery fund budget will be. Now I'm going to recommend something in SB 800, the bill I'm here to testify on, that some of you will yawn when I say this, when I say the words task force. But this task force that I'm proposing, it's a legislative task force. I actually think the people who best understand the issues that we face here are the people here in this building in the legislative branch. It's a bicameral task force made up of members of both the House and Senate. It's bipartisan, made up of both members of both major parties. If you were to look at the sponsorship on the task force, it has 8 chief sponsors: myself, Senator Hass, who is obviously the chair of this committee, Senator Boquist, who is actually the vice chair and ranking Republican member on the committee, Senator Winters, who is the vice chair of the Ways and Means Committee and the ranking Republican member on that committee. In the House, Representative Buckley, my counterpart as co-chair of Ways and Means. Representative Smith, who is one of the vice chairs of Ways and Means and the ranking Republican member. Representative Bentz, Representative Bentz, who is I believe the vice chair and the ranking member of the House Revenue Committee, and Representative Barnhart, the chair of the House Revenue Committee. So I think it's a pretty good list of sponsors. The questions have already been outlined to you. One of the things that you have in your possession is a letter from Pew. I've had some discussions with Pew. They actually initiated the discussions. They are willing to assist us in any way they can with research and assist LFO and LRO in terms of this task force. You have a letter from them clearly indicating that interest. I mean, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. Are our reserve funds adequate? Or if you want to think about it more appropriately, just how inadequate are they? Is probably how I would phrase it. Do they correlate with the volatility of the revenue system we have? Now, of course, there are two ways to look at that. You could look at it how much reserve funds you may need. You may look at how you might change the revenue system to make it less volatile. Have we used them appropriately? One of the things I will tell you is that many of us were here in 09. If I had 09 to redo again, I probably would have done it a little differently. I wasn't the co-chair of Ways and Means at the time. I'm not critical of the co-chairs of Ways and Means at that time. But the reality is we had an abundance of federal money. And at the same time, we depleted the reserve funds almost completely in that one biennium. And to be honest, we left ourselves in 11, 13 with literally no reserves, no significant federal funds, and probably having to face some of the worst cuts that I've ever had to make in budgets. So I think that is a big question. Have we used the funds appropriately? Are the triggers, transfers, and limits placed on the reserves appropriate? Should we be expanding the current dedications to the reserve funds? Are there other things we should be dedicating? There are just many more questions that need to be addressed. I know that most members yawn when you say the word task force. But I'm looking at this task force as being a way to get something that will have bicameral and bipartisan support that we can actually move forward in the next session because time is running short. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. $746 million at the end of 2015-17 sounds impressive until you remember that in 2011 we cut $3.5 billion from budgets.
Yeah. It's it sounds like a lot, and I think sometimes the public misunderstands reserve funds. They are not meant to avoid cuts. They are meant to moderate cuts. And to be honest, the depths of the recession that the economists tell us ended in something like the middle of 2009, which I think we're still, in a sense, recovering from in many ways, no amount of reserve funds would have gotten us through that without pain. The reality was it was so traumatic. You can imagine that if the federal government had not actually put out all those additional funds, which I think were a double-edged sword, to be honest. I think they helped us get through the recession. I think, though, particularly, and I get all not two people too happy with me, they made our expectations, particularly in human services expenditures, unrealistic, because we went through a period when we had an incredible match rate for federal dollars, an 18-month period where we would normally have received about $1.69 for every dollar of state funds. For 18 months, we got $2.69 approximately for every dollar. So we got an extra $1 million for every $1 million we put in, almost giving the people the impression that during the middle of the recession, we could fund at levels which was needed in a sense because of the depths of the depths of the need within the state and the number of people that were displaced from their jobs and the level of misery in the state. But at a sense, too, it gave us a false impression about what our future capabilities would be in the area.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin. Just some clarification for the record, and then a couple of questions and comments, because I'm signed on to 800, as you can see. And I just remind everybody, I signed on to the carbon tax study and got crucified, and it was a good thing we did it, because we now know certain things aren't what people thought, so we have a way to go forward. I'm actually signed on to a couple of health care bills that everybody's upset about costs, and Senator Devlin, I fully agree to you, and I'll state it differently. We got addicted to money in health care, and now we have this addiction, and we no longer can afford our drugs. And so that problem exists, and so the task force, I fully understand, because we have a problem coming. I was here like everybody else, and you'll recall people seem to forget about it, two election cycles, that we cut $5 billion in real money out, not growth, we cut $5 billion out of the all fines budget. We cut it. I mean, went out of other funds and every place else. We're now, getting into my question, we're in the either pick it, the longest, we're in the top two longest stock market runs in history. Which the last two times it either ended in a massive recession or it ended in the Great Depression. And I'm always optimistic, and I love it. My former friend or former representative, Jim Thompson, and you kind of share the same thing, Senator Devlin, which we're hopeful this is 4 or 6 years in front of us. And I'm well beyond thinking 4 to 6 years. You and I have had this discussion before. So we're in deflation. It's a fact of life. We don't know what that means. Europe's been in it for 6 to 9 months officially, according to the European Union and the economists over there. We're now about a month into it. We don't know what that really means because other than Japan, we have no example. But my question is, what should we do? Because this task force, 2 years. In your mind, what should we do as a stopgap measure without spending the money? What should we do in a stopgap measure before we leave on June 30th of this year, if anything?
If we were courageous?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. If we were foolish enough to not worry about reelection, yes.
Yeah. If you're courageous, you'd probably limit the amount of the kicker going out, and you'd put the bulk of the remaining funds into the reserve account. That would get you a little bit better off by the end of this next biennium. I don't think you can easily just say, let's change the amount that's the ending fund balance to, you know, 2% or 3% right off the bat, because to be quite honest, most people believe that the co-chair's state school fund number is inadequate. And it would even be more inadequate if that was the case. I deal with people every day who think every budget that the co-chairs have recommended is inadequate. And I deal with people constantly that come to me and say that I cut $140 million out of human services. Well, we cut $140 million out of the governor's recommended human services budget. The underlying increase in the human services budgets is still the largest percentage increase of the big three budgets. It's moderated. It's roughly a little bit less than 12%. But that's based on probably usable revenue of considerably less than that, a percentage point or so less than that. It stays at about the same exact percentage as the current biennium in terms of the percentage of the general fund lottery fund. But I don't think there's an easy solution this session. I don't think actually obviously getting 20 and 40 votes to put part of the kicker into a reserve fund is an easy thing either. But I think it would be a prudent thing to do at this juncture.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Follow up. If we just extrapolate the disaster from 2008, 2009, 2010, which we all participated in, I said it was a $5 billion all funds budget cut in real dollars. You extrapolate that over to what is likely to happen in the next cycle, even if you're not in a great recession or a bigger recession, and we're just a normal one like we experienced, well, that's a $6 billion cut that could be facing us anywhere from 2, 4, or 6 years in front of us. What do you think of flattening? You're familiar with this, the work groups that are out there discussing how do you flatten the existing structure to make it a little bit more recession-proof? Any comment on those? Because you're talking reserve funds, and I'm over talking about the whole discussion of trying to do something revenue neutral that flattens the revenue structure out so we don't, so when we hit the wall and break through it, which we're going to have to do, it's a little, we don't fall off the Grand Canyon on the other side, as the good chairman likes to put the chart up there where we just drop in.
Should have put that up there today.
Should have.
Well, I think, you know, presuming you could actually get something through this building, and presuming that whatever you got through this building wouldn't be referred, and if it was referred, that you would be upheld. Doing whatever you can to limit the volatility in our revenue system would probably be a good idea. Now, I think the classic language that you always hear in this building is that, which is to some degree, there's a element of truth in this. During a good economy, we do incredibly well, incredibly well. During a modest downturn in the economy, we lose more revenue than people would anticipate. So, I mean, anything you can do to actually reduce that volatility would probably be beneficial in the long term. I actually think that, to be honest, it takes a combination both on the revenue side of decreasing the volatility, and it actually takes probably 4 to 6 years of discipline on the budget side to get us back into a good position.
We're looking at legislation under our tax reform banner that would sequester capital gains income into a stability fund, which would have the effect of really almost neutralizing the kicker because of that's where a lot of the tail wagging the dog comes from. And while this task force bill looks at functions and how to maintain an efficient rainy day fund, the hardest part about any kind of a fund is actually funding it. And I'm just wondering, from your perch as Ways and Means co-chair, what you think of that idea.
Well, I think if you like picked a level in terms of capital gains at which you would actually dedicate above that into the reserve fund, and then gradually brought down that level, because capital gains have actually represented at times a significant portion of personal income taxes. So if you just took them out and put them into reserve fund next year, I can tell you that 17-19 actually does not look good in terms of what the budget picture is right now. And so you potentially make that picture worse, if significantly worse, if you took all capital gains out of the revenue stream. But if you like set a cap at what portion of capital gains would be go into current revenue that we could utilize, and put the rest of it into a reserve fund, and started bringing that down over a period of time, I think it would help you to build a stronger reserve base. I also think that one of the things that needs to be debated here is on the reserve funds is what are the triggers. You know, the reality is, and I'm not saying it should be this way, but the Education Stability Fund is constitutional, and there is, you know, we pretty much have to follow the law in the Education Stability Fund. The General Purpose Reserve Fund is statutory, and all it takes is a single word, notwithstanding, to actually do something completely different with those funds or take them at any time. So.
Final question.
Senator
Quest. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin, you raise a good point, because a lot of the options, well, in fact, theoretically, almost all the options except a statewide property tax could require a vote of the people,
yeah.
You know, or either vote of the people or a change in the Constitution. That's why I kind of asked the question, as you know, that you don't go to 40 and 20 and 40, you go to a referral to the people and say, hey, you know, folks, we have a problem. What's your druthers here? Do you want us to try and solve the problem this way, or do you want us to get out our butcher knife and start cutting the $6 to $8 billion or higher? I think the number is higher because of our drug addiction to health care. Do you think about this session? Because this is all takes time. If you put it, say, we're going to do it now, you're not going to put it on the ballot till 16. If you come back in 16 or even a year from now and say, well, we need to fix this constitutionally, it's going to be 2 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And we're bumping up against a fairly significant market correction. Now, everybody, what that market correction looks like, none of us know. But that's my point here, because you're talking 20 and 40, and I'm back talking, you know, 16 and 31, and we tell the people, okay, here's a choice. I mean, we either start fixing it now, because if we come back in a year or 2 years, it'll be 4 years before we give them that choice.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that, of doing something now to the people? And let them vote on it versus?
Well, I think you could take one of these options and refer it to the people. I do not know what the reaction would be. Generally, my underlying belief is most things that the legislature refers to the public that doesn't have significant backing outside the building has very little, if any, resources to basically communicate to the public about what's in the measure. And if there's any opposition at all to the measure, that opposition usually has an abundance of resources compared to what the legislature can muster. And they have to do that, obviously, outside the building. But things that we refer that don't have significant backing from someone usually suffer from basically what we can do is get it in the voter's pamphlet, do a few statements on it, go to a few editorial boards. I mean, we've done some of those that have actually passed more in terms of, you know, really more straightforward things that are not that controversial. But I think you could refer. The other thing on the task force, you know, if the task force had really broad support, I think the task force could actually report to the 2016 session with a recommendation. But my experience with task forces has been we create a task force, some good, some not so good, and then it's about October before we get appointments to task forces. This one should probably, if we were going to try to get a solution or something that we could actually embrace in the short 2016 session probably should be appointed before we leave the building here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
No one else is here to testify on Senate Bill 800. We do have a presentation from Dr. Warner on 800. Does that feel like 10 minutes? 10 minutes? Okay.
You need the screen.
Yeah, I need the screen. Sorry. Okay, thank you, Anna. Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I just, this, of course, is something I've spent a lot of the last 20 years looking at intensely. So just to summarize some of the things that we've looked at over the years as background to this particular bill, and I would see this kind of material as the kind of thing that you'd look at initially from the task force standpoint to get started on the kind of analysis that Senator Devlin went through with you. But if you look at the definition around a budget stabilization bills, the NCSL did a pretty comprehensive report on this. It's several years old now. It actually goes back to about the beginning of the Great Recession. But these are the characteristics that are laid out in the NCSL definition, and you can see that some of these meet the major funds that we have. One is that a fund is intended for general purposes. Our Education Stability Fund doesn't quite meet that, but they still count that in terms of their categorization. Of course, the other key element is it's designed to offset the cyclical downturn. So it's something that's not designed to be used over time, but rather to offset the downturns that occur in the cycle. These are the key elements of the stabilization funds. These are where the focus of the policy decisions would lie in these areas. We are, and I believe at the time of the NCSL study, we're one of only three states with multiple funds, so with the Oregon Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund. I believe you've seen this before, but this is the using that NCSL categorization, you can see how our reserve funds rank, or what components that are used in each of those categories. As the chair pointed out, really one of the key issue, really more important than the fund size or cap or the methods of withdrawal, is that method of deposit, because that's going to be is that method of deposit, does that generate money fast enough for you to have a substantial balance over the course of the cycle? So that means these have got, if you're looking at the average cycle lasting 5 years from trough to trough, then you need to build up these funds within a 4 to 5 year period. And you'll see one of the things that we've found certainly is that even though you think of this as a cyclical phenomenon and you use those funds during the biennium that the recession hits, there tends to be a lot of hangover going into the next biennium. As the co-chairs are trying to develop their budget, they've done a lot of one-time things. They've, as Senator Devlin pointed out, relied on federal money. And then that second biennium that follows the recession oftentimes is very much influenced by the recession. This is our current reserve position. As Senator Devlin pointed out, our available reserves are growing. You can see what our projected ending balance is for the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund. One of the components of the bill, the Senate Bill 800, is it appropriate to use interest earnings out of the Education Stability Fund? The Education Stability Fund
as you recall, really was an endowment fund. Originally, the idea was developed by Senator Gordon Smith when he was here, and referred to the people, and that set aside a portion of lottery funds for an endowment. So it had a long-term purpose, and the interest earnings were committed to certain uses, primarily for low-income scholarships. And those, as you went to a stability fund, really you're investing those dollars in short-term assets. As a stability fund, you're going to have to be committed to money market assets. But the interest earnings in the fund now continue from the legacy of what it was in the early, when it was in the mid-90s, are used for appropriation. So it does not accumulate its own interest. So that's, this has not been a major issue because interest rates have been so low, but at some point it could be. And you can see the rainy day fund does generate its own interest. The rainy day fund interest is actually can be used for cash flow purposes by the treasurer for the general fund, but it is kept track separately, and the interest earnings themselves are reinvested back into the fund. The other thing to keep in mind when you look at your reserve position, you have for 13-15, you have the ending balance for the two funds, but you also have your first line of defense, which is that general fund ending balance. And that is, if the economy is doing well as it is now, that's growing, and so our reserve position is actually very strong when you look at that $347 million. The point to keep in mind, though, that 347 basically goes away. The co-chairs are looking at that in terms of their budget. So it's really kind of a biennium to biennium contingency, not something that rolls over into the next biennium. And as Senator Devlin pointed out, the co-chair framework puts that projected ending balance number for the 15-17 for the budgets being developed about $200
million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, the 347.7 impact of kicker on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the kicker has no effect on these 13-15 numbers, but of course there is a correlation. If we're getting more money than we expect, we get a bigger ending balance, and that's what goes into the credit next biennium that goes out the door as the, and the credit that we're looking at is actually very close to that number. It's about $349 million is the credit we're looking at next biennium. But that shows up as a revenue loss in 15-17. One of the situations you'll be in now as you go into May with the May forecast is if the state economist raises the estimate for 13-15, you'll see this ending balance number go up, but that'll be largely offset by an increase in the kicker credit estimate. So you're kind of in a stabilizing period. With once that kicker is triggered, it tends to stabilize the revenue estimates.
Senator Bartsager.
And Dr. Warner, so trying to get this in, straight in my head. If the kicker kicks and we disperse those funds back to the taxpayer, then we really have a zero general ending balance. Is that correct?
Senator, the ending balance is not effect. I mean, the ending balance stays the same. The co-chairs are going to have this $347 million to use in their budget if this forecast is correct. What you lose is revenue next biennium. So what we're saying is revenue next biennium. If you didn't have the kicker, if you voted the did the two-thirds vote to change the estimate, as the Constitution allows you to do, then that 340, the estimate for 15-17 would go up by $349 million.
Okay.
So that's how it works. It's a revenue loss for next biennium. I should say it's actually, it would go up by less than 349 because now that we're with a credit, some of that revenue impact actually spills over into 17-19.
Thank you, Mr. Paul, just for clarification of the world out there behind you on the camera, could you go back and re-explain the kicker? Because I want to make sure people don't think a check is coming. It's really a tax credit.
It's a credit, yes. the kicker is, in its inception in 1979, it was established as a credit. The reason for the distinction between the threshold and the amount of the kicker was that there was a lot of concern on the part of the conference committee that developed it. They didn't want to have some de minimis kicker going out that wouldn't make sense to send out as a credit to taxpayers. So they set the 2% bar there, not because they thought it was some target for accurate predictions, but just so they would have a threshold, so that once it went over that, you went all the way back to the forecast, and therefore you had a substantial amount of a credit to return. So the credit operated throughout the 80s. We had kickers in 85, 87, 89. And then in the mid-90s, it was turned into a refund. And the refund was paid out. Checks were basically prepared by the Department of Revenue in October, November, and were sent out in November and early December. So that was right at the beginning of our biennium. The biggest budgetary problem we had with that method was, particularly when we had the large kicker in 07, was we were forced to borrow money externally through TANs, tax anticipation notes, in order to fund that refund because we didn't have the cash that early in the biennium. So it ended up adding to our costs of roughly $20 million for interest costs. In 2011, you change it back to a credit. So now taxpayers, as they were in the 1980s, they're going to get a percentage. Right now, the percentage would be, we estimate, about 5.1%. They calculate their liability, and actually it's tied to your liability before credits. You would calculate that and then apply that 5.1% credit. There'll be a box on your return, and you'll apply that, and that'll come off your tax bill.
Thank you for the clarification. I understood it, and I think all the committee members, but given the audience might be worldwide here.
As long as we're asking questions, you said a minute ago that the Ways and Means Committee will take that part of which fund for this biennium?
Mr. Chair, the Ways and Means Committee looks at, we make the distinction between general fund revenue and general fund resources. And general fund revenue would be the projected revenue for 15-17 plus the beginning balance. And that would be the resources that they would start with. So they'll plug that in their budget box that LFO prepares, that 347 will go in. Now, the other thing to keep in mind about that is that 347, 1% of that, which is about roughly $150 million, will go to the Rainy Day Fund. So that's the Rainy Day Fund receives that ending balance up to 1% of appropriations. So that will come out of that 347. So the 347 minus 150, that remainder would go into the co-chair's budget as a resource.
Okay.
So as we look at the issues going forward, these are the kinds of things that we've identified over time. As I said, rebuilding reserves is, at least in my view, the most important issue, because it's the hardest thing to do is to find the revenue source and put it aside and have it grow at an amount that would be adequate for the next downturn. Adequate size is your caps. An issue that we have continued to wrestle with in terms of fiscal policy in the state is around the role of the federal government. Senator Devlin just talked about how important federal stimulus money was during the 2009-11 biennium and even beyond somewhat. So that was a huge factor in allowing co-chairs to balance the budget. Of course, on our side of the building over here on the revenue side, oftentimes what the federal government does exacerbates the deficits because they're more concerned with stimulating the economy. They have no requirement to balance their budget. They'll often enact legislation such as depreciation changes, and you'll hear a bill on expensing, Section 179 expensing next. But they'll change those policies in order to stimulate investment in the economy to the automatic reconnect that usually costs us revenue. As we're required to balance our budget, then you have to come up with an offsetting, either budget cuts or revenue raising. And the other thing is, and we talked about this a lot in the early stages of the Great Recession, is to make the distinction between a cyclical downturn, which your reserve fund is designed to deal with, versus structural trends. Remember all the discussion about the new normal. That was what people were talking about. What are the structural revenue trends now? And, you know, we appear to be, and this is reflected in your forecast, have gone to a lower trend growth rate. And as the state economist has pointed out to you a number of times, we expect that to even trend lower, primarily because of the aging of the population and that impact it will have on our revenue structure.
Okay.
So if you look at kind of this notion of where we are in terms of the next recession, these are the reserve numbers. These numbers are an updated, slightly different than what Senator Devlin said. They built in the March numbers. And you can see total reserves are about 751 for the 15-17 biennium. And these are the probabilities we've talked about before, looking at a standard deviation on your general fund risk. A one standard deviation recession would generate a shortfall of about $530 million, probably something doable in terms of what you've experienced. A two standard deviation recession, which would be comparable to the Great Recession, would be about a $1.8 billion shortage in terms of the 15-17 budget. If you look at the next biennium, you can see that you're already starting to build up enough reserves. Your reserves get to $1.2 billion from the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund if they're allowed to grow at their projected growth rates and not used. Then you're able to basically work through a one standard deviation recession, which would be a mild recession comparable to the recessions, for example, we had in the early 90s. And then if you look at the deep recession, you would still have enough to meet, get it down to $1.6 billion in terms of the impact. So the timing is very important in building up those reserves to meet the shortfalls.
Mr. Chair, could you go back one slide, Paul? Just for the record, your slide has an error in it, so the public doesn't think we have $5.4 billion in the Educational Stability Fund. Am I correct? Second line, 17 to 19.
Oh, you're right, yes.
There's only 548.
548, yes.
Right, so there's not $5 billion in the Education Stability Fund.
Right.
Making sure there's it.
Yes.
Somebody doesn't think we're have
just
money.
Just updated that. He must have added the four. Sorry.
You could just end the hearing and go home.
Authorize the distribution to move on, right?
Okay, sorry about that. To look back on what the Pew Charitable Trust has recommended,
people will tell me, I'll spend the money.
And these are the things that they would if you look at the letter that was sent to you would help. And his regular studies, obviously, the Senate Bill 800 would certainly meet that. You want to tie this stabilization fund to these observed volatility and set the targets to match your experience with volatility. And of course, our volatility has proven that our potential risk is greater than it was in the past. These are the components of your forecast. The general fund standard deviation is about 7.2%. If you look at capital gains by themselves, as the chair pointed out, it's 41.2%. Corporate is about 30%. So those are your two sources of volatility. And if you look at those graphically, you can see that they're really the drivers behind the 01, 02 recession and the 07, 09 recession, particularly capital gains.
So the idea, Paul, on our backdoor tax reform thing would be possibly to take those peaks out and put those peaks into a rainy day fund until it got up to a certain percentage of the general fund. And
yes, exactly, Mr. Chair. You would see, I would suggest just taking a level, not even a growth factor, just taking the level of income tax collections from capital gains from the prior 2 years. And then if in the current biennium it exceeds that amount, then you clip that off, the amount above that, the prior 2 years, and put that in a reserve fund.
A level, like a dollar figure or a percentage?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Dollar figure.
So let's say that capital gains revenue was, well, you can see here, capital gains revenue is around $500 to $600 million per biennium. Let's say that for that prior 2 years it was $500 million, and then it turned out during the current biennium you got $700 million. Then you'd have $200 million that would go into the reserve fund.
Yeah. Senator Bartsugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Problem that I foresee with doing that is that means the budget committees are going to have to make some more adjustments in their budget.
That's right.
That's going to be a difficult sell.
That's right. At first, the hardest part about saving money is actually saving the money.
Right. That's correct, Senator. But remember, though, when you look at this, the 07, 09, when we got this big, huge peak here, this was, believe me, was not projected by the state economists, was not anticipated. I mean, yeah, the projections tend to be very close to what they were the prior 2 years. So, not always, but I mean, the projections do tend to match basically what we've seen. So, and they're much more stable than the actuals. So when you go above the trend, you're usually not anticipating that.
Okay. Well, you're saving more than you thought you were going to make.
I'm with you, bonus.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, the point is, Senator Devlin, the co-chair, said pretty much the same thing in his presentation. We have to be more frugal at the ways and means level. It takes both sides to make this thing work to get ready for the future. I do have a question of Mr. Warner, Mr. Chair, if you would please. Paul, just for clarification, the personal income, because this is the bar for personal incomes on capital gains, is really the result of, we'll just say hypothetically, individuals being smart enough to sell before the next crash. Is that not correct? Because they're selling when it's high and they're taking those profits now, and those that are sitting in the market when there's a market adjustment are going to see losses, which is the valley going down. Yes. Am I correct?
That's correct, Senator. There is, of course, up to a limit. You can subtract your losses off your gains on your tax return. So there is some interaction there. But and normally we don't see people, when they get capital gains, they usually don't get the maximum amount they could have gotten. I mean, if they were sold at the very peak. So, but once you get that sense in the market, as you know, then people start liquidating, getting out of the market, looking for other assets. Then you'll start to see the capital gains increase, actually, just as you're going into recession. You get a boost as people actually sell. But then once they're forced to sell or they're through their mutual funds, then we start seeing a lot of losses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so the last slide is just the kind of the things you've gone through with each of your revenue forecasts. You've seen these, the increasing economic volatility. We've really seen that in the last 10 years. We seem to have gotten past the period, what was called the Great Moderation, in which we went through a period where recessions were pretty mild. 1991 recession was mild, a long recovery. 0102 was a mild recession economically, not revenue-wise, but economically. Each of our recoveries have been slower and weaker, with the recovery we're in now being the slowest and weakest we've experienced in the post-war period. The revenue volatility has increased relative to the economic volatility, meaning that the ability to predict the economy is still obviously very important. But even if we get a situation where we had in the early 2000s where you have a mild economic downturn, if the components of income are right, a la the dot-com stock market bust, then you see a lot of decline in your revenue during that period. And I remember a good example of this in 0102 is Montana. Montana's economy is really not tied very much at all to the national business cycle. It has a lot of resource-based economic activity, mining and so forth. They barely experienced any kind of an economic downturn. Yet they're, of course, a non-sales tax state like us. And dependent on the income tax, their income tax revenue dropped sharply during that period. It was a major budget crisis for them, even though their economy was not declining. And again, that's from those components of income, primarily capital gains or other non-wage income sources that can be very volatile. We've talked about the unpredictability and also this notion that once you get into the recession, you begin your anti-recession budget balancing, you start looking for short-term short-term policies to try to get through it. It generally affects the next biennium, too. So you're looking at really a two-biennium period of which you've got a lot of fiscal stress in the system.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation. Senator Boquist.
Just an observation and a refresher from the state economist and the deal there. While Montana isn't impacted, they are now in a free fall, as is Wyoming, South Dakota,
yes,
and Texas, because they are natural resource-based and based on the price
of
oil right now. Their states are suddenly hurting. Well, we're kind of limping forward. And the last thing, and maybe Senator Bertschinger might have a comment too, I mean, in my district, because of the way it's laid out, there hasn't been a recovery. I mean, our jobless numbers are pretty much the same thing. I mean, there's been recovery in certain segments of the rural Oregon and much more in larger towns and cities, but those of us have districts that kind of sweep around in the rural areas, we just haven't seen the economic recovery out there.
No.
I mean, we're kind of still limping along, which we do thank our colleagues on the other side for helping with some of these economic development bills that we're trying to push forward for that particular purpose.
And I don't think that legalizing marijuana is going to help as much as we thought it was going to.
Unless they cause some sort of forest fire. All right. Thanks, Paul. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 800 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 438. Chris is here for a briefing, and Senator Olson is here to come up. Thank you, sir, for your patience. I hope it was educational for you to listen in on our discussion of rainy day funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was.
Go ahead, Chris.
Senate Bill 438 is a short bill. It selectively freezes our connection, a piece of our connection to the Internal Revenue Code for Section 179 expensing. As I think all the committee members are aware, there's this notion of depreciation and expensing, and depreciation is the deductions that are taken over the useful life of an asset. So a business buys some equipment, and they depreciate that. They're allowed to make a deduction every year over the useful life of that equipment, whether it be 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, or 10 years. There are different categories of equipment. The notion of expensing is essentially a 100% deduction. The full cost of the equipment gets to be expensed or deducted in that first year. And Section 179 is geared towards small businesses because of some of the limitations in the way it's structured. And at the federal level, this has become one of the extenders. And so at the federal level, every year or two, they extend the policy for a year or two at a time, often in December at the end of the tax year. So that has certain implications for businesses. And Senate Bill 438 freezes our connection to what was in effect in tax year 2013, basically keeping that policy in place. And then after the senator talks, I have some examples that I can go through.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Senator Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. And in reference to the prior testimony, my county is only back about 44 to 46% of employment compared to the rest of the state. So the rural counties do hurt. I brought this bill forward several times in my career. And the reason I do it is simply this. Small business needs capital. Liquidity in small business is critical to their growth and critical to their employment perspectives. And so with the opportunity to purchase equipment and regain your capital quickly allows the business to expand, to keep on their path to growth, and to hire more people. And as I said, capital is tantamount to any small business. It's a must. Most businesses fail because they aren't capitalized enough, and they lose money throughout the course of their business enterprise. As they buy equipment to expand their business, they end up losing the business because of the fact of this capitalization. And I feel that this bill will allow them to recoup this capital that they need so that they can move forward and provide more jobs for more Oregonians.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Senator Olson? Chris, maybe you could give us one of those hypotheticals that you were talking about.
Sure. So jumping to the bottom part of the handout here under the example, I've chosen a piece of property that gets depreciated over 5 years. So this top line here, and the effective date of the bill is 2016. So, and skipping over some of the details about the, because there are a lot of tables for how property gets depreciated. So I've just chosen one. It's a five-year depreciation that uses a mid-year convention or half-year convention. So a piece of property gets purchased in 2016, and that depreciation line shows how the deduction would play out over the, it's actually 6 years. So in 2016, 20% of the cost of that equipment would be deducted in 2016 and then 32% in 2017 and so forth. So the example here is a business purchases equipment costing $600,000. And under current law at the federal level, the Section 179 expensing is limited to $25,000. So they purchase equipment for $600,000 in 2016, and they are able to expense the $25,000 immediately in 2016. And the remaining $575,000 of that equipment cost gets depreciated over the 6 years. So the full deduction in 2016 is the $25,000 plus the $115,000. So it's $140,000. The $115,000 is 20% of the $575,000. And so the expensing is zero for 17 to 21, but the depreciation goes by that above schedule. And I should note that this ignores bonus depreciation. I was trying to go with as simple an example as possible. So it's not, it ignores bonus depreciation. So under Senate Bill 438, the Section 179 expensing for Oregon purposes would be $500,000. So that equipment cost of $600,000, the expensing in 2016 would be $500,000, and then the remaining $100,000 would be deducted over the life of the asset. So that's the $20,000 depreciation amount there is 20% of the $100,000. So the first year or the 2016 full deduction would be depreciation deduction would be $520,000. And the deduction difference there is the $380,000. So you go from $140,000 first-year deduction to $520,000 of deduction in the first year. Now, that increase in the depreciation deduction in 2016 is just, it's a timing thing. It just gets moved up. And so that's what the negative amounts are for tax years 2017 through 21. So at the end of the depreciation, at the deduction difference at the end on the far right, the total, there is no difference, just the full amount of the equipment cost gets deducted. It's all just when it gets deducted. And the tax impact, I just assumed a 9% rate for the sake of simplicity here. So 9% times the $380,000 would be a tax reduction of $34,200 in 2016, which corresponds to a tax, to an increase in 2017 and 2021 because you have a lower deduction compared to current law.
So it comes back around.
It comes back. So over the time period, there is no change. There is no, all the years taken together, there is no tax difference. There is no deduction difference.
It's when.
It's when. And if I could jump back up to the chart here, the most what I've been talking about right now is really the blue line there. There is a phase out for the Section 179, but ignoring the red lines right now, the blue line is the history of the Section 179 limit, and the table on the left provides the numbers for those. And you can see in 2002 it was $24,000, and that was the limit that could be expensed in the first year. And through a series of federal legislation over the past 10 years, that amount has been increased to $500,000 as recently as 2012 and 2013. And throughout much of 2014, to tie this to the federal reconnect bill that the committee has heard, I don't think the committee's acted on it yet. Throughout 2014, the law for the Section 179 limitation was $25,000. And then in December of 2014, Congress acted and increased that limit to $500,000. But they did so in December. So the law right now is $500,000 limit for 2014. Now, we are tied to that because of our rolling reconnect. So as soon as that took effect at the federal level, it affected the revenue impact on Oregon. But they did only extend that for 1 year. So as of right now, since January 1, 2015, the limit is $25,000. Now, everybody will have their own bet as to what Congress chooses to do this year and when. But part of what this does by freezing into 2013, and that's the box around 2013. It shows the policy that 438 ties to. It ties to the limitations there. And just a brief word about the phase out. Once the investment, there's a total annual cap for the amount that can be expensed here. If total equipment for 2013 is up to $2 million purchased by the business, they can expense the full $500,000. But once total qualified investment property starts to exceed $2 million, that $500,000 cap is reduced on a dollar-for-dollar basis. So if for the entire year a business purchases $2.1 million in qualifying property, their actual limit is $400,000. It's the $500,000 limit minus the amount above $2 million.
Plus the depreciation schedule on the balance.
Yes, I'm kind of skipping the depreciation. And bonus depreciation also plays into this. The actual numbers for the example get more complicated with bonus depreciation. But I'm just trying to be clear that that's not included. And if I wanted to be more accurate, it would be included, but that complicates the discussion a little bit. So the phase out, that's the solid red line, and the dashed red line is when it's gone, because it is produced on a dollar for dollar basis. So for the 2013 policy that we're talking about, by the time the total investment in qualified property hits $2.5 million, then the Section 179 expensing amount is eliminated. And that's how it's focused towards small businesses, because of that limitation, because large businesses are going to invest, you know, tens of millions of dollars, and so they've gone past that phase out.
Senator Boquist?
Question, Chris. In the infinite unwisdom of Congress, both Democrat and Republic, we'll just be bipartisan here. If I recall correctly, in 2014, Congress thought about, you know, finally decided they were going to do something, I think, in December. 2013 was November. I think virtually every year for the last 3 or 4 years, Congress has waited until at least October, November, December before they've thought about what they're going to do with this Section 179. Is that correct?
Yes. I would add in 2013, in I think for 2012, they actually acted in 2013. So they actually even went beyond the end of the tax year. Right.
They actually did it for once in advance.
No, it was after the end of the tax year.
Okay, even worse. Right, so Congress generally doesn't figure out what it's going to do with the Section 179, at least for the last 3 or 4 years, until end of the year or beginning of the next year. That's the correct statement?
Yes.
All right, so if we're taking a pool, it's going to get even more difficult.
The hard part is you have to purchase equipment and put it into use before the end of the year. So if you don't do that until the end of the year, that can be tough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Burchard.
So this bill keeps us tied to 179, or does this bill keep us tied to the $500,000 rate?
It ties us to the law that was in effect in 2013. The language of the bill, it can get a little bit convoluted or confusing, because it references the IRC as in effect on December 31st, 2013. For tax year 2013. So I think the easiest way to think about it is whatever the levels were, whatever the policy was in 2013, that's what we're tying to. And so that's the $500,000. And so the way it would play out on the tax returns is that there would be these additions and subtractions, because in the first year, they would be able to deduct more. So assuming we hit 2016, and let's say Congress doesn't change the law, that it actually drops down to $25,000 in 2015 and stays at that level. So in 2016, if 438 were in effect, at the federal level, a business that purchases equipment for $600,000, at the federal level, they'd be able to expense $25,000, and then the depreciation would land where it lands. For Oregon returns, they would be able to expense $500,000.
Got it.
So there'd be an addition of $475,000. But then there, it all balances out in the end. So then there would be these other, I mean, there would be a subtraction in 2016 to allow for a larger deduction.
So that's going to be in another form on the income tax, because the way it is now, we just work off the balances of the federal taxes we carried onto our Oregon tax.
Generally, that's true. We did disconnect in 2009 and 2010. So there is a bit of this adding and subtracting going on right now.
Senator Boquist?
So a bill such as Senate Bill 438, and we've had this discussion elsewhere, is sort of like us setting our own depreciation schedule. It's kind of an edge of that. It's on the same topic range, correct?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair characterization.
Okay.
Which sort of begs larger question that if we're going to do some of this, and this makes some sense, then, you know, look at a larger picture.
Correct, Mr.
Not,
Chair.
Not just doing this, but right. The whole picture, I think Dr. Warner's kind of encouraged us to look at doing that.
And the other piece of this is the depreciation. They are very much linked.
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously the larger picture, but even within this topic, the whole depreciation and expensing, you have the bonus depreciation and regular depreciation, so to speak.
Thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Any other comments or questions on this?
More stuff to digest.
No. Mr. Toad's wild ride goes on.
Okay, nothing else before us. The Senate Revenue Committee will adjourn. Senate Revenue Committee will adjourn.